and away, spinning them off downstream. Though the surface was smooth as a mirror and looked as if it could move at no greater pace than an ooze, the swollen river boomed along at the speed of a mill race. The dugout, partially filled with water, floated low in the river, just the spade-shaped bow fully above the surface. Inman had swallowed water, and he spit and spit until he could bring up nothing but white foam, trying to clear his mouth of the foul river, uglier water he had never tasted. The moon came and went among the clouds, and when there was enough light to aim by, rounds from the Whitworth hit the canoe, or struck the water and skipped off stuttering across the surface. Inman and the girl tried to kick with their legs and steer the upturned boat to the western shore, but in its heaviness it seemed to have a mind of its own, and would in no way do their bidding. They gave up and let themselves be carried along, just their faces above water. There was nothing to do but hang on and wait for a bend in the river, and hope that the evening would present something to their advantage. From down in it, the river looked even wider than from the bank. The foul country passing along on either side was vague and ominous in the moonlight. Inman's hope was that it would strike neither mark nor impress on his middle workings, so vile did its contours lie about him. Even from out in the river he could hear that the bugs squealed among the poison ivy without pause. He was but a little head floating in a great void plain, bounded by a dark jungle of venomous plants. Any minute he figured to see the white, bewhiskered maw of the monster catfish rise from the water and suck him in, all his life adding up to no more than catfish droppings on the bottom of this swill trough of a river. He floated along thinking he would like to love the world as it was, and he felt a great deal of accomplishment for the occasions when he did, since the other was so easy. Hate took no effort other than to look about. It was a weakness, he acknowledged, to be of such a mind that all around him had to lie fair for him to call it satisfactory. But there were places he knew where such would generally be the case, Cold Mountain, Scape Cat Branch, and right now the first impediment to being there was 100 yards of river. After a time the moon was blinded again by clouds, and they drifted past the landing, and Inman could hear the men talking as clearly as if he stood amid the group. One man, evidently the owner of the Whitworth, said, "It was daylight, I could shoot the ears off his head with this thing." Long moments later the moon again appeared. Inman raised up and looked across the dugout. Way back at the ferry landing he saw little figures waving their arms and jumping up and down in their rage. They receded, and he could think of many things that he wished could similarly just get smaller and smaller until they disappeared. The main evidence of their existence was the occasional splash of lead, followed at some interval by the report of the long rifle. Like lightning and thunder, Inman thought. He occupied the time counting the seconds between the slap of a ball and the faint pop. He could not, however, remember the way you were supposed to figure distance from it, nor did he know if the same principle applied. The river eventually swept them around a bend and put the landing out of sight. Now that they could safely get to the other side of the canoe, they could kick to some effect, and in short order they fetched up on land. That side of the canoe was shot to pieces beyond repair, so they left it wallowing in the shallow water and set out walking upstream. When they got to the house, Inman gave the girl more money as compensation for the old dugout, and she gave him directions for finding the roads west. Some few miles up, this river forks out into the Haw and the Deep. The Deep's the left fork, and you'll stay near it for some time, for it runs mainly from the west. Inman walked on up the river until he reached the forks, and then he went into the brush until he was hid. He dared not light a fire to make corn mush, and so he ate but a green windfall apple he had picked up out of the road, and the cheese and dry biscuit, which now carried a strong foretaste of the Cape Fear. He kicked together a bed of duff deep enough to keep him off the damp ground, and stretched out and slept for 3 hours. He awoke sore and bruised about the face from the fight. Blisters of poison ivy beaded up on his hands and forearms from his flight through the flatwoods. When he put a hand to his neck, he found fresh blood where his wound had cracked open and leaked, from the strain of whipping the three men or from the soaking in the river. He took up his packs and set off again, walking.
Verbs, all of them tiring. The agreement Ada and Ruby reached on that first morning was this.
Ruby would move to the cove and teach Ada how to run a farm. There would be very little money involved in her pay. They would take most of their meals together, but Ruby did not relish the idea of living with anyone else, and decided she would move into the old hunting cabin. After they'd eaten their first dinner of chicken and dumplings, Ruby went home and was able to wrap everything worth taking in a quilt. She had gathered the ends, slung it over her shoulder, and headed to Black Cove, never looking back. The two women spent their first days together making an inventory of the place, listing the things that needed doing and their order of urgency. They walked together about the farm, Ruby looking around a lot, evaluating, talking constantly. The most urgent matter, she said, was to get a late-season garden into the ground. Ada followed along, writing it all down in a notebook that heretofore had received only her bits of poetry, her sentiments on life and the large issues of the day. Now she wrote entries such as these. To be done immediately. Lay out a garden for cool season crops. Turnips, onions, cabbage, lettuce, greens. Cabbage seed, do we have any? Soon. Patch shingles on barn roof. Do we have a mall and fro? Buy clay crocks for preserving tomatoes and beans. Pick herbs and make from them worm boluses for the horse. And on, so much to do, for apparently Ruby planned to require every yard of land to do its duty. The hayfields, Ruby said, had not been cut frequently enough, and the grass was in danger of being taken over by spurge and yarrow and ragweed, but it was not too far gone to save. The old cornfield, she declared, had profited from having been left to lie fallow for several years, and was now ready for clearing and turning. The outbuildings were in fair shape, but the chicken population was too low. The root cellar in the cow house was, in her estimation, a foot too shallow. She feared a bad cold spell might freeze potatoes stored there if they didn't dig it deeper. A martin colony, if they could establish one alongside the garden and gourd houses, would help keep crows away. Ruby's recommendations extended in all directions, and she never seemed to stop. She had ideas concerning schedules for crop rotation among the various fields, designs for constructing a tub mill, so that once they had a corn crop, they could grind their own meal and grits using water power from the creek, and save having to give the miller his tithe. One evening, before she set off in the dark to walk up to the cabin, her last words were, "We need us some guineas. I'm not partial to their eggs for frying, but they'll do for baking needs. Even discarding the eggs, guineas are a comfort to have around and useful in a number of ways. They're good watchdogs, and they'll bug out a row of pole beans before you can turn around. All that aside from how pleasant they are to look at walking around the yard." The next morning, her first words were, "Pigs, do you have any loose in the woods?" Ada said, "No, we always bought our hams." "Well, there's a world more to a hog than just the two hams," Ruby said. "Take lard, for example. We'll need plenty." Despite the laxity of Monroe's tenure at Black Cove, there was nevertheless much more to work with than Ada had realized. On one of their first walks about the place, Ruby was delighted by the extensive apple orchards. They had been planted and maintained by the blacks and were only now beginning to show the first marks of inattention. Despite lack of recent pruning, they were thick with maturing fruit. "Come October," Ruby said, "we'll get enough in trade for those apples to make our winter a sight easier than it would be otherwise." She paused and thought a minute. "You don't have a press, do you?" she said. When Ada said she thought they might indeed, Ruby whooped in joy. "Hard cider's worth considerably more in trade than apples," she said. "All we'll have to do is make it." Ruby was pleased, too, with the tobacco patch. In the spring, Monroe had given the hired man permission to plant a small field of tobacco for his own use. Despite most of a summer of neglect, the plants were surprisingly tall and full-leaved and worm-free, though weeds grew thick in the rows, and the plants were badly in need of topping and suckering. Ruby believed the plants had thrived despite disregard because they must have been planted in full accordance with the signs, and said that if they cured the leaves and soaked them in sorghum water and twisted them into plugs, they could trade off tobacco for seed and salt and leavening and other items they could not produce themselves. Barter was very much on Ada's mind, since she did not understand it, and yet found herself suddenly so untethered to the money economy. In the spirit of partnership and confidence, she had shared with Ruby the details of her shattered finances. When she told Ruby of the little money they had to work with, Ruby said, "I've never held a money piece bigger than a dollar in my hand." What Ada came to understand was that though she might be greatly concerned at their lack of cash, Ruby's opinion was that they were about as well off without it. Ruby had always functioned at arm's length from the buying of things, and viewed money with a great deal of suspicion, even in the best of times, especially when she contrasted it in her mind with the solidity of hunting and gathering, planting and harvesting. At present, matters had pretty much borne out Ruby's darkest opinions. Scrip had gotten so cheapened in its value that it was hard to buy anything with it anyway. On their first trip together into town, they had been stunned to have to give $15 for a pound of soda, $5 for a paper of triple-aught needles, and 10 for a quire of writing paper. Had they been able to afford it, a bolt of cloth would have cost $50. Ruby pointed out that cloth would cost them not a cent if they had sheep, and set about shearing, carding, spinning, winding, dyeing, and weaving the wool into cloth for dresses and underdrawers. All Ada could think was that every step in the process that Ruby had so casually sketched out would be many days of hard work to come up with a few yards of material coarse as sacking. Money made things so much easier. But even if they had it, shopkeepers really didn't want money, since the value of it would likely drop before they could get shut of it. The general feeling was that paper money ought to be spent as soon as possible, otherwise it might easily become worth no more than an equal volume of chaff. Barter was surer. And that, Ruby seemed to understand fully. She had a head full of designs as to how they might make Black Cove answer for itself in that regard. In short order, Ruby had devised a plan. She put it to Ada as a choice. The two things she had marked in her inventory of the place as being valuable and portable and inessential were the cabriolet and the piano. She believed she could trade either one for about all they would need to make it through the winter. Ada weighed them in her mind for 2 days. At one point, she said, it would be a shame to reduce that fine dapple gelding to draw in a plow. And Ruby said, he'll be doing that whichever way you pick. He'll have to work out his feed like anybody else around here. Ada finally surprised even herself by settling on the piano to part with. Truth be told, though, her hand at the instrument was not particularly fine, and it had been Monroe's choice that she learned to play it to begin with. It had meant so much to him that he had hired a teacher to live with them, a little man named Tip Benson, who seldom kept a position for long, as he could not refrain from falling in love with his charges. Ada had been no exception. She was 15 at the time, and one afternoon, as she sat attempting a baffling passage from Bach, Benson had fallen to his knees by the piano bench and pulled her hands from the keys and drawn them to him and pressed their backs to his round cheeks. He was a plump man, no more than 24 at the time, with extraordinarily long fingers for one of his squat build. He pressed his pursed red lips to the backs of her hands and kissed them with great ardor. Another girl of Ada's age might have played him to her advantage for a time, but Ada excused herself right then and went straight to Monroe and told him what had passed. Benson had his bags packed and was gone by supper time. Monroe immediately hired as music tutor an old spinster with clothes that smelled of naphtha and underarms. Part of Ada's reasoning in choosing the piano for barter was that there would be little room for art in her coming life, and what place she had for it could be occupied by drawing. The simple implements of pencil and paper would answer her needs in that regard. She could see all the good reasons for parting with the piano. What she was not clear on were the reasons for keeping the cabriolet. There was the fact that it had been Monroe's, but that did not feel like the holding point. She worried that it was the mobility of the thing that held her to it, the promise in its tall wheels, that if things got bad enough, she could just climb in and ride away. Be like the blacks before her, and take the attitude that there was no burden that couldn't be lightened, no wreckful life that couldn't be set right by heading off down the road. After Ada made her decision known, Ruby wasted no time. She knew who had excess animals and produce, who would be willing to trade favorably. In this case, it was old Jones up on East Fork she dealt with. His wife had coveted the piano for some time, and knowing that, Ruby traded hard. Jones was finally made to give for it a pied brood sow and a shote and 100 pounds of corn grits. And Ruby, thinking how wool was such a useful thing in so many ways, especially with the current high cost of fabric, allowed that it wouldn't hurt to take on a few of the little mountain sheep, not much bigger than a mid-sized breed of dog full-grown. So she convinced Jones to throw in a half dozen of them as well, and a wagon load of cabbages, and a ham, and 10 pounds of bacon from the first hog he killed in November. Within a matter of days, Ruby had driven the hogs and the little sheep, two of them dark, up into Black Cove. She shooed them onto the slopes of Cold Mountain to fend for themselves through the autumn, fattening on what mast they could find, which would be plenty. Before she let them go, she'd taken out her knife and marked their left ears with 2 smooth crops and a slit, so that they all fled bloody-headed, squealing and bleeding, to the mountain. Late one afternoon, old Jones came with a wagon and another old man to get the piano. The two stood in the parlor and looked at it a long time. The other old man said, "I'm not so sure we can lift that thing." And old Jones said, "We've got the advantage of it. We have to." They finally got it into the wagon and roped it in tight, for it hung out past the tailboard. Ada sat on the porch and watched the piano ride away. It jounced down the road, the unsprung wagon hitting hard on every rut and rock, so that the piano played its own alarming and discordant tune in farewell. There was not a lot of regret in Ada's mood, but what she thought about, as she watched the wagon go, was a party Monroe had given 4 days before Christmas, in the last winter before the war. The chairs in the parlor had been pushed back against the walls to make room for dancing, and those who could play took turns at the piano, beating out carols and waltzes and sentimental parlor tunes. The dining room table was loaded with tiny ham biscuits, cakes and brown bread and mince pies, and a pot of tea fragrant with orange and cinnamon and clove. Monroe had caused only a minor scandal by serving champagne, there being no Baptists in attendance. All the glass-bowled kerosene lamps were lit, and people marveled over them and their crimped chimney tops like the petals of buds opening, and had not yet become general. Sally Swanger, though, expressed the fear that they would explode, and she judged the light they cast as too glaring and said tapers and hearth light suited her old eyes better. Early in the evening, people formed like-membered groups and gossiped. Ada sat with the women, but her attention flickered about the room. 6 old men drew up chairs near the fire and talked of the looming crisis in Congress, and sipped at their flutes, and then held them up to the lamplight to study the bubbles. Esco said, "It comes to a fight, the Federals will kill us all down." When others in the group violently disagreed, Esco looked into his glass and said, "A man made liquor with a bead like this, he'd be judged unsound." Ada also paid mild heed to the young men, sons of valued members of the congregation. They sat in a back corner of the parlor and talked loudly. Most of them disdained the champagne and drank only somewhat surreptitiously from pocket ticklers full of corn liquor. Hob Mars, who had briefly paid poorly received court to Ada, announced, as if speaking to the room at large, that he had celebrated the Savior's birth every night for a week. He claimed that from those parties dull enough to have ended before dawn, he had lit his way home by pistol fire. He reached and took a drink from another man's flask and then rubbed the back of his hand across his mouth and looked at it and rubbed again. "It's got a whang to it," he said loudly, and passed the flask back. Women of mixed ages occupied another corner. Sally Swanger wore a new pair of fine shoes, and she sat awaiting comment on them, her feet out before her like a stiff-legged doll. Another of the older women told a somewhat extended tale of her daughter's poor marriage. At the husband's insistence, the daughter shared a house with a family of hounds, who lounged about the kitchen at all times but coon hunts. The woman said she hated to go visit, for there was always dog hair in the gravy. She said her daughter had for several years produced 1 baby after another, so that contrary to her earlier wildness to be married, the daughter now viewed matrimony in a dim light. She'd come to see it as a state summing up to little more than wiping tails. The other women laughed, but Ada felt for a moment as if she could not catch her breath. Later the groups mixed, and some stood around the piano and sang, and then some of the younger people danced. Ada took a turn at the keyboard, but her mind hovered above the music. She played a number of waltzes and then left the piano and watched, amused, as Esko arose, and, to no accompaniment other than his own whistling, performed a solitary shuffle step during which his eyes glazed over and his head bobbed like it hung by a string. As the evening went on, Ada found that she had taken more than one glass of champagne beyond the prudent. Her face felt clammy and her neck was sweating under the ruching at the tall collar of her green velvet dress. Her nose felt as if it had swollen, so much so that she pinched it between thumb and forefinger to check its breadth, and then went to the hall mirror, where she was startled to see it looking normal. Sally Swanger, apparently under the sway of Monroe's champagne as well, had at that moment pulled Ada aside in the hallway, and in a whisper said, "That Inman boy just got here. I should keep my mouth shut, but you ought to marry him. The two of you'd likely make pretty brown-eyed babies." Ada had been appalled by the comment, and blushing fiercely, she fled to the kitchen to compose herself. But there, throwing her thoughts into further disarray, she found Inman, alone, sitting in the stove corner. He had arrived late, having ridden through a slow winter rain, and was warming up and drying out before joining the party. He wore a black suit and sat with his legs crossed, his wet hat suspended from the toe of a dress boot near the hot stove. The palms of his hands were held up to catch the heat of the fire, so that he looked like he was pushing something away. "Oh, my," Ada said, "there you are. The ladies are already so pleased to know you're here." "The old ladies," Inman said. "Well, everyone. Your arrival has been noted with particular approval by Mrs. Swanger." This called up a vivid and unplanned image, its theme suggested by Mrs. Swanger's comment, and Ada felt a rushing in her head. She blushed again and quickly added, "And by others, no doubt." "Not feeling qualmish, are you?" Inman said, somewhat confused by her behavior. "No, no," Ada said. "This room is just close." "Well, you look flushed," he said. Ada touched her damp face at various points with the backs of her fingers. It could not think of a thing to say. She made calipers with her fingers and took the measure of her nose again. She went to the door and opened it for a breath of cool air. The night smelled of wet, rotting leaves and was so dark she could not see beyond the drops of water catching the door light as they fell from the porch eave. From the parlor came the simple first notes of Good King Wenceslas, and Ada recognized Monroe's stiff phrasing at the piano. Then, from out in the dark, over a great distance, came the high, lonesome baying of a gray wolf far off in the mountains. "That is a forlorn sound," Inman said. Ada held the door open and waited to hear an answering call, but it never came. "Poor thing," she said. She closed the door and turned to Inman, but when she did, the heat of the room and the champagne and the look on Inman's face, which was softer than any contour she had ever seen there, conspired against her, and she felt at once faint and giddy. She took a few uncertain steps, and when Inman half stood and reached out a hand to steady her, she took it. And then by some mechanism she was unable to reconstruct later, she found herself in his lap. He put his hands to her shoulders a moment, and she settled back, with her head beneath his chin. Ada remembered thinking that she never wished to leave this place, but was not aware that she had said it aloud. What she did remember was that he had seemed as content as she was, and had not pressed for more, but only moved his hands out to the points of her shoulders and held her there. She remembered the smell of his damp wool suit, and a lingering smell of horse and tack. She might have rested in his lap for half a minute, no more. Then she was up and away, and she remembered turning at the door, her hand on the casing, to look back at him where he sat, with a puzzled smile on his face, and his hat lying crown down on the floor. Ada went back to the piano, where she moved Monroe aside and played for quite some time. Inman eventually came and stood, leaning with his shoulder against the door jamb. He drank from a flute and watched her for a while, and then he moved on to talk to Esko, who still sat near the fire. Through the rest of the evening, neither Ada nor Inman mentioned what had taken place in the kitchen. They talked only briefly and awkwardly, and Inman left early. Much later, In the small hours when the party broke up, Ada looked from the parlor window and watched as the young men went down the road, firing their pistols toward the heavens, the muzzle flash lighting them in brief silhouette. Ada sat a while after the wagon bearing the piano rounded the bend in the road. Then she lit a lantern and went to the basement, thinking that Monroe might have cellared a case or two of champagne there, and that opening a bottle now and again might be pleasant. She found no wine, but turned up instead a genuine treasure, one that greatly advanced their efforts toward barter. It was a 100-pound sack of green coffee beans that Monroe had stored away, sitting there fat and sagging in a corner. She called Ruby, and they immediately filled the roaster and parched a half pound over the fire and ground it, and then brewed up the first real coffee either of them had had in over a year. They drank cup after cup and stayed up most of the night, talking nonstop of plans for the future and memories of the past, and at one point Ada retold the entire thrilling plot of Little Dorrit, one of the books she had read during the summer. Over the next several days, they bartered the coffee by the half pound and by the nogginful to neighbors, keeping back only 10 pounds for their own use. When the sack was empty, they had taken in a side of bacon, 5 bushels of Irish potatoes, and 4 of sweet, a tin of baking powder, 8 chickens, various baskets of squash and beans and okra, an old wheel and loom in need of minor repair, 6 bushels of shell corn, and enough split shakes to re-roof the smokehouse. The most valuable trade, though, was the 5-pound sack of salt they had gotten, it having become so scarce and dear that some people now dug up their smokehouse floors and boiled and strained the dirt and then boiled it down and strained it again, over and over until the dirt was gone and the water steamed away, so that in the end they had reclaimed the salt fallen to the ground from the hams of yesteryear. In such matters of trade, and in every other regard, Ruby proved herself a marvel of energy, and she soon imposed a routine on Ada's day. Before dawn, Ruby would have walked down from the cabin, fed the horse, milked the cow, and be banging pots and pans in the kitchen, a hot fire going in the stove, yellow corn grits bubbling in a pot, eggs and bacon spitting grease in a black pan. Ada was not accustomed to rising in the gray of morning. In fact, through the summer, she had rarely risen before 10. But suddenly, there was little choice. If Ada lay abed, Ruby would come roust her out. Ruby figured setting things to working was her job, not waiting on somebody and doing their bidding. On the few occasions when Ada had slipped and given her an order, as if to a servant, Ruby had just looked at Ada hard and had then gone on doing what she was doing. What the look said was that Ruby could be gone at a moment's notice like morning fog on a sunny day. Part of the code for Ruby was that though she did not expect Ada to do the cooking at breakfast, she did expect her, at minimum, to be there to watch its conclusion. So Ada would walk down to the kitchen in her robe and sit in the chair in the warm stove corner and wrap her hands around a cup of coffee. Through the wind of the day would be starting to take shape, gray and loose in its features. Even on days that would eventually prove to be clear, Ada could seldom make out even the palings of the fence around the kitchen garden through the fog. At some point, Ruby would blow out the yellow light of the lamp, and the kitchen would go dim, and then the light from outside would rise and fill the room. It seemed a thing of such wonder to Ada, who had not witnessed many dawns. All through the cooking and the eating, Ruby would talk seamlessly, drawing up hard plans for the coming day that struck Ada as incongruent with its soft vagueness out the window. By the time summer drew toward its conclusion, Ruby seemed to feel the approach of winter as urgently as a bear in autumn, eating all night and half the day to pack on the fat necessary to feed it through hibernation. All Ruby's talk was of exertion, the work it would take to build a momentum of survival to carry them through winter. To Ada, Ruby's monologue seemed composed mainly of verbs, all of them tiring: plow, plant, hoe, cut, can, feed, kill. When Ada remarked that at least they could rest when winter came, Ruby said, "Oh, when winter comes, we'll mend fence and piece quilts and fix what's broke around here, which is a lot." Simply living had never struck Ada as such a tiresome business. After breakfast was done, they worked constantly. On days when there was not one big thing to do, they did many small ones, choring around as needed. When Monroe was alive, living was little more laborsome than drawing on bank accounts, abstract and distant. Now with Ruby, all the actual facts and processes connected with food and clothing and shelter were unpleasantly concrete, falling immediately and directly to hand, and every one of them calling for exertion. Of course, in her previous life, Ada had taken little part in the garden Monroe had always paid someone to grow for them, and her mind, in consequence, had latched itself to the product, the food on the table, not the job of getting it there. Ruby disabused her of that practice. The rudeness of eating, of living, that's where Ruby seemed to aim Ada every day that first month. She held Ada's nose to the dirt to see its purpose. She made Ada work when she did not want to, made her dress in rough clothes and grub in the dirt until her nails seemed to her crude as the claws of a beast, made her climb onto the pitched smokehouse roof and lay shakes, even though the green triangle of Cold Mountain seemed to spin about the horizon. Ruby counted her first victory when Ada succeeded in turning cream to butter. Her second victory was when she noted that Ada no longer always put a book in her pocket when she went out to hoe the fields. Ruby made a point of refusing to tackle all the unpleasant work herself, and made Ada hold a struggling chicken down on the chopping block and cleave off its head with a hatchet. When the bleeding, headless body staggered about the yard in the time-honored habit of sots, Ruby pointed to it with her ragged sheath knife and said, "That's your sustenance there." The force that Ruby used to drive Ada on was this. Somewhere Ada knew that anyone else she might hire would grow weary and walk away and let her fail. Ruby would not let her fail. The only moments of rest were after the supper dishes had been washed and put away. Then Ada and Ruby sat on the porch, and Ada would read aloud in the time remaining before dark. Books and their contents were a great novelty to Ruby, and so Ada had reckoned that the place to begin was near the beginning. After filling Ruby in on who the Greeks were, she had begun reading from Homer. They usually covered 15 or 20 pages of an evening. Then, when it became too dark to read, and the air turned blue and started to congeal with mist, Ada would close the book and solicit stories from Ruby. Over a period of weeks, she collected the tale of Ruby's life in pieces. As Ruby put it, she'd grown up so poor she was forced to cook with no more grease than you would get wiping the frying pan with a meat skin, and she was tired of it. She had never known her mother, and her father had been a notorious local ne'er-do-well in Scofflaw called Stobrod Thews. They lived in a dirt-floored cabin, little better than a roofed pen. It was tiny, and had about it the air of the temporary. About the only thing distinguishing it from a gypsy caravan was its lack of wheels and floor. She had slept on a kind of miniature loft platform, just a shelf, really. She had an old tick for mattress that she stuffed with dried moss. Because there was no ceiling, only the geometrical pattern made by the lapped undersides of the roof shakes, Ruby awoke many a morning with an inch of snow atop her pile of quilts, blown by the wind between the curled edges of the shakes like sifted flour. On such mornings, Ruby found that the great benefit of such a small cabin was that even a fire of twigs warmed it up fast. Though the faulty chimney that Stobrod had constructed drew so poorly, you could have smoked hams in the place. In all but the foulest weather, she preferred cooking out back under a brush arbor. Yet little and plain as it was, the cabin was still more than Stobrod cared to maintain. If not for the inconvenience of his having a daughter, he might happily have taken up dwelling in a hollow tree, for in Ruby's estimation, an animal with memory was about her father's loftiest expression of himself. Feeding herself was Ruby's to do as soon as she was old enough to be held accountable for it, which, in Stobrod's opinion, fell close after learning to walk. As an infant, Ruby foraged for food in the woods and up and down the river at charitable farms. Her brightest childhood memory was of walking up the river trail for some of Sally Swanger's white bean soup, and on the way home having her nightgown, for several years her usual attire even in the daytime, get caught on a trailside blackthorn briar. The thorn was long as a cockspur, and she had been unable to free herself. No one passed that afternoon. Broken clouds blew over, and the day faded like a guttering lamp. Night fell, and the moon was black, the new moon of May. Ruby was 4, and spent the night attached to the blackthorn tree. Those dark hours were a revelation to her, and they never left her. It was chill out in the drifting mists of the river bank, She remembered shivering and crying for a time, calling out for help. She feared she would be eaten by a wandering panther down from Cold Mountain. They would carry off a child in a heartbeat, was what she had heard from Stavrod's drinking friends. The way they told it, the mountains were full of creatures hungry for the meat of a child. Bears out foraging, wolves roaming. Hants aplenty, too, in the mountains. They would come in many forms, all terrifying, and they would snatch you up and take you to who knew what manner of hell. She had heard the old Cherokee women talk of cannibal spirits that lived in the rivers and ate the flesh of people, stealing them near daybreak and carrying them down in the water. Children were their favorite food, and when they took one, they left in its place a shade, a twin, that moved about and talked but had no real life to it. 7 days later it withered and died. The night drew together all those threats, and young Ruby thus sat for some time, shivering from the cold and sobbing until she could hardly breathe from the recognition of all the things that seemed ranked up to prey on weakness. But later she was spoken to by a voice in the dark. Its talk seemed to arise from the rush and splatter of the river noise, but it was no cannibal demon. It seemed some tender force of landscape or sky, an animal sprite, a guardian, that took her under its wing and concerned itself with her well-being from that moment on. She remembered every star pattern that passed across the piece of sky visible to her among the tree boughs, and every word spoken directly to her deep core by the calm voice that took her in and comforted and protected her all through the night. She stopped shivering in the thin gown, and her sobbing passed away from her. The next morning a man fishing set her loose, and she walked home, and never spoke a word to Stavrod about it, nor did he ask where she had been. The voice, though, still echoed in her head, and after that night she became like one born with a call over one's face, knowing things others never would. As she got older, she and Stavrod had lived off what Ruby raised on the little bit of their land that diverged far enough from the vertical for her to plow. For his part, her father spent his time elsewhere, often disappearing for days at a stretch. He'd walk 40 miles for a party. At even the rumor of a dance, he would head out down the road, toting the fiddle from which he could barely scratch out a handful of standard figures. Ruby might not see him again for days. Lacking that sort of entertainment, Stavrod would go off to the woods, hunting, he claimed. But he usually provided only an occasional squirrel or groundhog for the stewpot. His ambitions never rose as high as deer, so when rodents were scarce they ate chestnuts and rhubarb and poke and other wild food that Ruby gathered, so it could often be said that a large part of their diet was mast. Even Stavrod's love of liquor failed to make a farmer of him. Rather than grow corn, he would go out with a tow sack on moonless nights when the ears were ripe and steal corn. From it he distilled a greasy yellow liquor which his fellows claimed was unmatched in rawness and potency. His one known flirtation with employment had ended in disaster. A man from down the river had hired him to help finish clearing a piece of new ground to ready it for spring planting. The big trees had already been felled and lay in great tangles of tree laps piled at the wood's edge. The man wanted Stavrod to help him burn them. They lit a roaring fire and were lopping limbs off the downed trees so they could roll them into the fire when Stavrod suddenly came to the realization that this was more work than he had reckoned on. He turned his shirt sleeves down and headed up the road. The man kept at it alone, working with a log hook to try to roll the tree trunks into the fire. He was standing near the flames when several burning logs shifted and trapped his legs tight down among them. Try as he might, he could not break free, and he hollered for help until his voice gave out. The fire kept moving his way until, rather than be burned up, he took the axe he had used for lopping limbs and hewed away his leg just at the knee. He tied off the bleeding with a strip of his pant leg twisted tight with a stick, and then trimmed a forked limb into a crutch and walked home. He lived, but just. For years thereafter, Stavrod was wary of walking the road by the man's house, for the peg-legged man had, to Stavrod's bitter disappointment, held a grudge, and would sometimes take a shot at him from the porch. It was not until Ruby was nearly grown that it occurred to her to wonder what kind of woman her mother had been to have married such a man as Stavrod. But by then her mother seemed to have been wiped nearly clean from the slate of his mind, for when Ruby asked what she had been like, Stavrod claimed he had little recollection. "I can't even see in my mind whether she was slight or stout," he said. To the surprise of one and all, in the first days of the war fever, Stavrod had enlisted in the army. He rode off one morning on their old Henny to do battle, and Ruby had heard nothing from him since. Her last remembrance of him was his white shanks shining above his boot tops as he jostled away down the road. She guessed that Stavrod had not warred for long. He had surely died in his first fight, that or deserted forever, for Ruby had heard from a man of his regiment, come home with an arm shot off, that Stavrod was unaccounted for after Sharpsburg. Whatever his fate, whether he had taken a mini-ball to his hinder parts or lit out for the Western Territories, he had left Ruby high and dry. Without the Henny, she could no longer even plow the sorry fields. All she was able to plant was a little garden that she worked by hand with a single-foot plow and a hoe. The first year of the war had been hard for her, but at least Stavrod had left his old unrifled musket, figuring he stood a chance of bettering his weaponry if he showed up empty-handed. Ruby had taken the relic piece, more relative to the harquebus than to the current fashion in rifles, and hunted wild turkey and deer through the winter, jerking the venison by the fire like an Indian. Stavrod had taken their only knife, so she sliced up the meat with one she had made from a cast-off section of a cross-cut saw. Her principal tool for the job of bladesmith was the hammer. She heated the saw blade in the fire and scribed a knife shape in the hot metal with a bent horseshoe nail she had picked up out of the road. When the metal cooled, she hammered off the excess from the scribed line and filed burrs from the blade and haft. Again using the hammer, she pounded in rivets made of scrap copper to hold a handle of apple wood that she had sawed from a thick limb. She honed the blade keen on greased river rock. Her handiwork was rough-looking, but it cut as good as a bot-knife. Looking back on her life so far, she listed as achievements the fact that by the age of 10, she knew all the features of the mountains for 25 miles in any direction as intimately as a gardener would his bean rows, and that later, when yet barely a woman, she had whipped men single-handed in encounters she did not wish to detail. At present, she believed herself to be 21 years old, though she did not know for sure because Stavrod had not marked down in his memory either the year of her birth or the day. He could not even recall the season it had been when she arrived. Not that she was planning a birthday party, for celebration had been a lacking feature of her life, since survival had such a sharp way of focusing one's attentions elsewhere.
Like any other thing, a gift. Late in the night, Inman followed a road of sorts that ran along the banks of the deep river. It soon dipped into a rocky swale that after a time narrowed and made a gorge. The sky closed up between walls of jumbled rocks and trees until it was only a swath directly above, Milky Way the only light. It was so dark that for a time down in the cut he had to feel with his feet for the soft dust of the road to keep his way. The sheen of light on the water was so slight that he could see it only by looking to the side, like detecting faint stars by not peering right at them. Eventually, traversing a rocky bluff, the road became a narrow notch between the river, below a drop-off, and a steep bank of broken rock and dirt, grown partly over with brush. Inman did not like his position. He feared the home guard would be out and about. Horsemen might be upon him before he could find a place to leave the road, and the bank was too broken and steep to climb quietly in the dark. It would be a poor place to make a stand against armed riders. Best to step on out smartly and put this wound in the earth behind him. Inman broke into a painful little jog trot and kept at it for some minutes, until he saw up ahead a flickery light, which looked to be right in the courseway. He slowed to a walk, and soon he had closed on the light near enough to tell that it was made by a man in a broad-brimmed hat, standing in the road, casting a yellow circle around him from a smoky torch of bundled pitchwood splits. Walking quietly, Inman eased closer and stopped alongside a boulder not 10 yards away. The man wore a suit of black clothes, a white shirt. He held a horse by a lead rope tied around its neck. In the light, Inman could see that the horse carried a burden, an unformed white thickness across its back like a drooping bundle of linen. As Inman watched, the man sat down in the road and drew his knees up toward his chest with one arm.
The elbow of his torch arm rested in the notch between the knees, so that his fist stuck out before him, and held the fire as steady as if fixed in a sconce. He let his head sink down until the hat brim touched his extended arm. He made a kind of illuminated dark wad in the road. "He's going to fall asleep with that torch blazing," Inman thought. "In a minute he'll have his feet on fire." But the man was not dozing. He was in despair. He looked up toward the horse and let out a moan. "Lord, oh Lord," he cried, "we once lived in a land of paradise." He rocked from side to side on the bones of his ass and said again, "Lord, oh Lord." What to do, Inman wondered. Another stone in his pathway. Couldn't go back, couldn't go around, couldn't stand there like a pinned heifer all night. He took out the pistol and held it up to catch what light reached him from the torch and checked his loads. Inman was about ready to make his move when the man stood and worked the base of the torch around in the dirt until it held upright. He rose and walked to the horse's far side. He began trying to lift the bundle from the horse, which shifted about nervously and put back its ears, the whites of its eyes visible all along the lower rims. The man got the bundle off the horse and over his shoulder and came walking from behind the animal in a kind of stagger. Inman could see that what he was lugging was a woman, one limp arm swinging, a cascade of black hair brushing the ground. The man carried her from out the diameter of torchlight so that they became near invisible, but his direction was clearly toward the verge of the drop-off. Inman could hear the man sobbing in the dark as he walked. Inman ran along the road to the torch and grabbed it up and pitched it softly underhand out toward the sound of crying. What the fire lit when it struck ground was the man, standing on the very lip of the bluff with the woman in his arms. He was trying to whirl to see the source of this sudden illumination, but, cumbered as he was, it took some time. With a kind of shuffle, he turned to face Inman. "Set her down," Inman said. She dropped in a heap at the man's feet. "The hell kind of pistol is that?" the man said, his eyes fixed on the two big mismatched bores. "Step away from her," Inman said. "Get over here where I can see you." The man stepped across the body and approached Inman. He held his head tipped down for the hat brim to cut the glare from the torch. "Best stop right now," Inman said when the man got close. "You're a message from God saying no," the man said. He took two steps more and then dropped to his knees in the road and fell forward and hugged Inman about the legs. Inman leveled a pistol at the man's head and put pressure on the trigger until he could feel all the metal parts of its firing mechanism tighten up against each other. But then the man turned his face up and it caught the light from the torch, where it still burned on the ground, and Inman could see that his cheeks were shiny with tears. So Inman relented as he might have anyway, and only struck the man a mid-force blow across the cheekbone with the long barrel of the pistol. The man sprawled in the road on his back, a shallow cut below his eye. His hat had fallen off, and his head was pomaded slick as an apple from the forehead back, and the ends of his yellow hair hung in ringlets about his shoulders. He fingered the cut and looked at the blood. "I accept the merit of that," he said. "You merit killing," Inman said. He looked where the woman lay in a heap at the edge of the bluff. She had not moved. "I might still feel the need to do it," Inman said. "Well, don't kill me. I'm a man of God," the man said. "Some say we all are," Inman said. "A preacher's what I mean," the man said. "I'm a preacher." Inman could think of no response but to blow out air from his nose. The preacher rose again as far as his knees. "Is she dead?" Inman said. "No." "Well, what's the matter with her?" Inman said. "Not much. She's somewhat with child, that and what I gave her." "What would that be?" "A little packet of powders that I bought off a peddler. He said it would put a man to sleep for 4 hours. It's been about half that since I dosed her up." "And you're the daddy?" Inman said. "Apparently." "Not married to her, I reckon." "No," the preacher said. Inman stepped to the far side of the girl and knelt. He put a hand to her dark head and lifted it. She was breathing with a kind of faint snore, a whistle at the nose. Her face was slack from being senseless, and the shadows cast from the torch were ugly things, collecting unfavorably in the low spots of her eyes and cheeks. Still, Inman could tell that there might be a beauty to her. He returned her face to the ground and rose from his crouch. "Put her back on the horse," Inman said. He stepped away, keeping the pistol leveled at the man, who hopped up to his feet, his eyes never leaving the barrel ends. The man hustled over and knelt, and struggled to lever the girl off the ground. He rose and staggered to the horse and threw her over. Inman tipped the big pistol up momentarily to catch its profile in the light, thinking how very much he liked the air of urgency and focus it lent to a simple request. "What now?" the man said when he was done. He seemed relieved for someone else to be calling the decisions. "Hush up," Inman said. He did not know what was next, and his thinking seemed all grainy and sluggish from lack of sleep and hard walking. "Where did you come from?" Inman said. "There's a town not far off," the man said, gesturing on up the road in the direction Inman was heading. "Get on out ahead of me and show the way." Inman picked up the torch and threw it over the ledge. The preacher stood and watched it fall, a diminishing point in the dark. "Still the deep river here," Inman said. "Folks call it that," the preacher said. They started walking. Inman kept the pistol in his hand and led the horse with the other. The lead rope was thick hemp, and the end had been wrapped for some inches in wire to prevent its fraying, and as he grasped the rope he pricked his thumb, drawing blood. Inman walked along, sucking at his cut thumb, thinking had he not stumbled upon them, the woman would be a white smear floating on the black river, her skirts belled out around her, and the preacher standing up at the road saying, "Go down, go down." Inman wondered what the thing to do here would be. The road soon climbed and crossed a little ridge and left the river behind. It wound through low hills. The moon had risen, and Inman could see that the land lay open in great patches where the forest had been burned away to make place for fields. But nothing more toilsome than lighting a fire had been done with it, and so it was a country of black stumps set in runnel-cut clay, stretching away bare to a far horizon. The charcoal of the stumps caught the moonlight and glittered. Inman looked about and thought, "I could well be on a whole other planet from the place I'm aiming for." Orion had fully risen and stood at the eastern horizon, and from that Inman made the time to be long past midnight. The great figure of hunter and warrior stood up there like an accusation, like a sign in the sky pointing out your shortfalls. Orion was girded about tight, his weapon ready to strike, sure of himself as a man can be if posture is any indication of character. Traveling due west every night, and making unfailing good time. One of the things Inman marked as a comfort was that he could put a name to the brightest star in Orion. He had shared that fact with a Tennessee boy on the night after Fredericksburg. They had sat at the lip of the ditch behind the wall. The night was cold and brittle, and the stars were sharp points of light, and the aurora had already flared up and gone out. They had blankets wrapped about them, draped over their heads and shoulders, and their breaths blew out in plumes, and hung in the windless air before them like spirits in process of departure. "It's so cold you used to lick your gun barrel your tongue'd bind to it," the boy had said. He held his Enfield up before his face and breathed on the barrel of it, and then scratched at the place with a fingernail and raked off frost. He looked at Inman and then did it again. He held the finger up for Inman's inspection, and Inman said, "I see it." The boy spit between his feet and then bent to witness if it froze, but the bottom of the ditch was too dark to tell yes or no. Before them was the battlefield falling away to the town and the river. The land lay bleak as nightmare and seemed to have been recast to fit a new and horrible model, all littered with bodies and churned up by artillery. Hell's new ground, one man had called it. To turn his mind from such a place that night, Inman had looked toward Orion, and said the name he knew. The Tennessee boy had peered up at the star so indicated and said, "How do you know its name is Rigel?" "I read it in a book," Inman said. "Then that's just the name we give it," the boy said. "It ain't God's name." Inman had thought on the issue a minute and then said, "How would you ever come to know God's name for that star?" "You wouldn't. He holds it close," the boy said. "It's a thing you'll never know. It's a lesson that sometimes we're meant to settle for ignorance." "Right there's what mostly comes of knowledge," the boy said, tipping his chin out at the broken land, apparently not even finding it worthy of sweeping a hand across its contours in sign of dismissal. At the time, Inman had thought the boy a fool, and had remained content to know our name for Orion's principal star, and to let God keep his a dark secret. But he now wondered if the boy might have had a point about knowledge, or at least some varieties of it. Inman and the preacher walked in silence for some time until finally the preacher said, "What do you intend doing with me?" "I'm thinking on it," Inman said. "How did you get in this fix?" "It's hard to say. None in the settlement suspect a thing even yet. She lives with her grandmother. So old and deaf you must scream to make yourself understood. It was an easy matter for her to slip away at midnight, to sport in a hayrick or on a mossy creek bank, until the first birds began singing in the hour before dawn. All through the summer we crept about the night woods for our meetings." "Crafty as panthers in the ways of stealth," Thinman said. "Is that the picture you're painting?" "Well, yes, after a fashion." "How did it come to pass?" Inman asked. "A certain look of eye, bend of voice, brush of hand in passing the chicken when we had dinners on the ground following Sunday services." "Well, there's a smart distance between that and you with your breeches around your ankles in a hayrick." "Yes," the preacher said. "Even further to you getting set to picture in a gorge like a shoat dead of the hog cholera." "Well, yes," the preacher said, "but it's more tangled than you make it to be. For one thing, there's my position. If we'd been found out, I would have been run from the county. Our church is strict. We've churched members for as little as allowing fiddles to be played in their houses. Believe me, I anguished over it through many a night." "Those would be the rainy nights," Inman said, "when the hayricks and moss banks were too damp." The preacher walked on. "There were simpler repairs," Inman said. "Well, I could not find them." "Marry her would be one." "Again, you miss the tangles," the preacher said. "I am already betrothed." "Oh," Inman said. "I now believe that when I took to preaching, I answered a false call." "Yes," Inman said, "I'd say you're ill-suited for that business." They walked another mile, and then before them, on the banks of a river, the same as flowed at the bottom of the gorge, was a kind of town, a collection of wood structures, a clapboard church, whitewashed, a business or two, houses. "What I believe we're going to do," Inman said, "is put her back in her bed like this night never happened. Have you a kerchief?" "Yes." "Wad it up and put it in your mouth and lie face down in the dirt," Inman said. He stripped the wire off the lead rope while the preacher did what he was told. Inman walked up behind the preacher and put a knee in his back and wound the wire around his head a half dozen turns and then twisted the ends together. "If you had screamed out," Inman said, "people would come running, and you could lay this all off on me. There's no way I could tell it to make myself believed here." They entered the town. At first dogs barked, but then, recognizing the preacher and familiar with his nighttime rambles, they fell silent. "Which house?" Inman said. The preacher pointed on down the road and then led the way through the town and out the other side to a little grove of poplars. Set back among the trees was a tiny cottage, just one room, covered over with batten boards and painted white. The preacher looked toward it and nodded. The way the wire stretched back the corners of his mouth made him look all a grin, an expression ill consisted with Inman's mood. "Back up to this little poplar," Inman said. He took the lead rope off the horse and with it tied the preacher by his neck to the tree. Inman took the loose end of the rope and drew it over the preacher's shoulder, tied his wrists together behind him. "Stand here real quiet and we'll all live through this," Inman said. He lifted the girl from the horse and adjusted her in his arms to a good balance for carrying, an arm under her waist, another under her soft thigh backs. Her dark head rested on his shoulder and her hair swept across his arm like a breath as he walked. She gave a little moan like one briefly troubled in regular sleep by a passing dream. She was such a helpless thing lying there without even consciousness as defense, exposed to every danger and guarded only by the rare goodwill of the random world. "I'll yet kill that shitpoke preacher," Inman thought. He carried her to the house and set her down in a patch of tansy by the stoop. He went onto the porch and looked in a window to a dim room. A fire burned low on the hearth, and an old woman slept on a pallet by the fire. She had lived so long to have achieved a state of near transparency, her skin the color of parchment, as if, were Inman to snatch her up and hold her in front of the fire, he could read a paper through her. Her mouth was open, snoring. The little bit of light left in the hearth lit up the fact that she had but two pair of teeth remaining, one pair in front on top, the other in front on bottom. The effect was hair-like. Inman tried the door and found it unlatched. He opened it and stuck his head in. He said, "Hey," in a Midland voice. The old woman snored on. He clapped his hands twice, but she still did not stir. Safe enough, he decided, and walked on in.